Welcome to Let's Get To, the baseball podcast from the fan's perspective. Now here's your host, James Christopher.
And welcome back to Let's Get To. I am your host, James Christopher. And as usual, we have a really cool show. We're going to be joined by the voice of the Dayton Dragons. And we're going to be joined by half of the team behind the excellent books Ballpark to Ballpark, which features a wide look at minor league and independent baseball all over the country. Stay with us. And before we dive into what is going to be a fun packed show, we do want to talk a little bit about, again, one of our favorite teams to cover, the Corpus Christi Hooks. Now, we talk a lot about what minor league baseball in particular means to community and the ways that they reach out to the community and the ways that they really insert themselves into the communities in which they play baseball. And as we discussed with J.D. Davis a few weeks ago on the show, Corpus Christi occupies a really unique footprint for minor league baseball in the state of Texas, because it really isn't just the city of Corpus Christi, but you've got all these coastal towns in what we call the Coastal Bend area of Texas, and that includes Port Aransas, that includes Aransas Pass, Corpus Christi, Rockport, all of these areas up there. Some of those, unfortunately, are names you might have heard when Hurricane Harvey hit a few years ago. Well, in keeping with the mission of reaching out and being a part of the community like what the Hooks do, they had what they called Coastal Bend Weekend. And it really was a series of events across 2 weekends that began with an effort to encourage to get people out to clean up the beaches, to do a conservation act. So on June 8th, the Hooks did a thing called the Hooks Beach Sweep. And those in the Coastal Bend community had a chance to join a bunch of Hooks players and staff. And they did a cleanup. And those who showed up and those who made it out got a beach sweep t-shirt and then a ticket to the Hooks game on June 20th. And that brings us to Coastal Bend Weekend, in which part of which Jessica and I and Nathan and Shelley took her parents down for. So on June 20th, they wore special uniforms that said Coastal Bend. And again, on June 20th, they had people that volunteered to clean up the beach or out for the game. And then, as often happens with a lot of these special jerseys, these jerseys were auctioned off, and then the money was going to help keep the beaches in Corpus Christi and the Coastal Bend clean. Now, what wasn't very fortunate for Astros fans, but worked out really well for Corpus Christi in this endeavor, was that George Springer and Colin McHugh and others were making their rehab start. And, you know, these guys, the Hooks played the Coastal Bend's jerseys, including those players. Those jerseys go up for auction. And because of the presence of Springer and folks like that, they were able to kind of auction off some of those jerseys for more. And so just a really cool opportunity to directly impact the community that the Hooks play in. And those of you who aren't from Texas know that we're really, really proud of the statement, "Don't mess with Texas." And I'm not sure everybody that's not a Texan understands the real genesis of the name. And in fact, really what it is it's about keeping Texas clean. And it started out really as for lack of a better term, an ecology slogan about keeping beaches clean, keeping our parks clean and stuff like that. So it's great to see the Corpus Christi Hooks continuing that effort and making sure that the beaches that we all love so much stay nice and clean.
And now the Big League Chew, an eye on the majors.
And we're back on Let's Get To with the Big League Chew, and Scott McIntyre's here to talk all things MLB. Scott, first of all, this National League Central, before we jump into it, and I'm hitting you with a slider, I didn't tell you it was coming in. Is that the most competitive division in baseball?
I think so. I do. And I think we knew it was going to be too. The Cubs, you know, Joe Maddon is an exceptional manager, and that pains me to say being a Cardinals fan, but Joe Maddon is extremely good. Craig Counsell has shown that he can manage a ball club with the Brewers, and all of these teams have just a ton of talent, and they have different types of talent. And as you guys with the Astros found out recently, even the Reds are really good. The Reds, you know, we talked about this. Any of these five teams could win the division. I mean, you got five teams that are 5.5 games apart from each other, and you're near the All-Star break. So anything can happen there. I do believe, from what I've seen locally, if you look at the Cardinals are hitting really badly. The Cardinals' starting pitching is not been consistent. If the Cardinals find a way to get things where they should be, the Cardinals could take off on a streak in this division. So there's hope there. But if the Cardinals continue to play the way they are, it's going to be third season in a row with hopes dashed.
Hopes dashed, yeah. But going back to the going back to the Red Stockings, that's not what they were called. They were the Red Legs or something. Whatever they were. They changed their name. They changed their name in the 50s too for a while because of the whole Red Scare thing. But it looks like Cincinnati has been baseballed all season because, yeah, they are four games under 500, only I think 5.5 back. But they're actually in the top 10 in run differential, which is sometimes the greater stat as far as who is good and who is not.
Yeah, that's typically the litmus test, right? That's what you go and look at. So where should a team be? The run differential will typically tell you that. And Cincinnati is very high on that list. I think they're a team that is still gelling and could get better. I think the Pirates, the same thing can be said there. The Cubs could slip. The Brewers are probably going to be where they're at. The Cardinals are either going to be where they are or maybe take off, like I just talked about. But the Pirates and the Reds each have this potential to get a whole lot better than people thought they would be. And those are the types of teams that if they sneak into the wild card, they can cause a lot of havoc, kind of like the Brewers did last year and get into the NLCS.
Yeah, I might actually cross – kind of go a different direction with you on the Pirates just because they have the fourth worst run differential at minus 72, whereas the Reds are plus 48, I think. So, but yeah, it's definitely, again, we're talking about a division that's top to bottom and 5.5 games separates them. You're right. In as far as in the division, you're one good week away.
Yeah, completely agree. Completely and totally agree. The Pirates, I know to look at them on paper, they're not playing where they should be. I just think the talent is there, and they're young. And you know, Josh Bell is such an incredibly powerful player. I know they've dealt with some injuries, and then you look at what they just did to the Padres. I don't know if you realize this, but the Padres set a record Sunday night, Sunday the June 23rd, as being the only team in I think the history of Major League Baseball, at least like 75 years, to have a three-run lead after the eighth inning, lose it, get another three-run lead after the eighth inning, and lose it again. To lose the game in 11 innings, 11-10, to said Pirates. So, that takes a lot of guts. Not just any team is going to erase a three-run lead in the bottom of the ninth, give up three in the top of the 11th and score four in the 11th to win the game. So I'm not. I would love to give up on the Pirates because they're in a division where I wish they were really bad, but they're not.
Well, I'll tell you what. As a Cardinals fan, we're going to do our best to create some separation for you starting tomorrow night.
I would love that. And we're going to do our best to give you a couple of more games over the A's starting tomorrow night.
Good. Yeah, we need to do that. George Springer's coming back. Methinks he's going to have some stuff to do. But let's talk a little bit about right now. It's interesting because I for as much as it doesn't matter, I do follow like the ESPN power rankings and stuff. And only the second time this season they have the unanimous number one, and that number one is the Dodgers. So but I know you had wanted to kind of talk a little bit about, and it is the thing where I think baseball is so weird because you have so many divisions where it's very few are as competitive as the Central in the National League. Whereas most, it's almost now foregone conclusion who's winning each division. But what are your thoughts on the Dodgers this year so far?
So you can't argue with the record, right? First of all, okay. 54-25.
And you play the record you're given. You can't. You play the record. You play the schedule you're given.
Completely agree. The team with the best record in modern baseball was the 2001 Seattle Mariners. They won 116 games. You can go back and look at the 1954 Indians that won 111 games, or the 69 Orioles. You can go back through history. Even the Cardinals. The 2004 Cardinals that won 105 games. you can go back and look at all of these teams that played amazingly well, even the Dodgers of 2017 that won 104, and they don't make the World Series. A lot of times, I can't explain why. I could speculate that it's because they have an easier schedule in the regular season, so they win more games. I think that was the case with the Mariners when they set the record. The other thing is that, they could be like the Black Sox, right, and win just a ton of games and then throw the World Series, or throw it all.
That's a hot take, buddy.
But you also look at a team like the Dodgers, and they play so well, and they don't have a lot of a lot of hurdles to climb during the regular season because they're winning so many games, and then they get to the postseason, and for lack of a better term, they choke out. Now, the Dodgers kind of look like that type of team to me. They haven't faced the amount of adversity that most other teams with a similar record have had this year. I look at the Yankees, I look at the Astros, I look at the number of injuries that both teams have had and they've had to overcome. I look at a team like the Braves in the NL East right now. I look at their horrible back end pitching, which I'm saying this so we can segue onto something I know you want to. But I look at a team like the Braves. In all seriousness, you know, they've won 59% of their games, which is really good. But they've had a ton of adversity to overcome. The Dodgers have not had that. Everything's been nice and sunny in Chavez Ravine. And I think that the Dodgers are just look like one of those teams that does really well in the regular season and has a ton of hurdles to overcome late. That's not to take anything away from their team. Cody Bellinger is incredible. He's absolutely fantastic. But the pitching that they've had at the level they've had,
particularly the back end of that bullpen, it is not, and yeah, I don't know that you can make one move and make it better.
I completely agree. There are chinks in the armor that are showing themselves now, and the regular season record may not play out to show that, right? It very well, they may win 110 games. That's not beyond the realm of possibility. But I just don't think they're a World Series winning team. And that, I guess, is the hottest take I can possibly give right now. I don't see them making the World Series.
Oh, that's interesting. You don't even see them making. I do think that they feel a little bit like the Buffalo Bills to me, for all of our viewers who are under the age of 30. The Cowboys used to win Super Bowls all the time, and two of them were against the Buffalo Bills. But it does kind of feel like that kind of team.
Yeah, it completely does, especially because you're going to have teams come out of the East and the Central that are just battle-tested. They're used to being down late. They're used to having to win one-run games. They don't get the Giants, and the Padres, their competitive level. If you look at how they started out versus what their record has been over the last half of the season as it's been played so far, the Padres are falling off horribly like we thought. But the Brewers, the Braves, the Phillies, the Cards or the Cubs, if these teams make it, they can be really, really, really hard outs for a team like the Dodgers. So,
yeah, and I want to I think the other thing, too, before we move on, the one thing about the Dodgers, too, is you can say, and you brought up the Yankees and you brought up the Astros, who had just the kinds of injuries that would have in a less deep organization, would have crippled them for the season. You know, both teams. And what's funny is that the Astros and Yankees have not played together healthy yet. So I've been talking to Yankees fans online, and everybody's reaction is, well, we still don't really know because it sort of flipped. But I don't know that I don't know that the Dodgers have that deep of an organization because they're going to be injuries. That's just how the game works. Do you think they're going to be able to survive? Like, if Bellinger goes down, can they survive that?
Well, we know that they've had a lot of good minor league talent in the past because of, you know, how we've seen their AA organization win championships. The AAA team has been competitive. I don't know if they have enough that's stocked in the bullets that aren't loaded in the chamber. I don't know if they have enough to restock what they might lose. It really depends on what they lose. You can't replace a Cody Bellinger, right? You have great difficulties fulfilling the star power that the Astros, for example, have had to replace for long stretches of time. At the same time, when you've had guys go down and you've had to pull people up from AAA, I don't know if the Dodgers have that. Certain pieces, if they don't have, then they can get by for a little bit of time. But I don't know. I don't think it's there. We'll see. Injuries are going to happen at some point. The game's played for too long of a period of time. There's too much wear and tear that happens on the knees and the arm. Somebody's going to get injured at some point, and then we'll see how resilient they are.
Right. So speaking of Astros and former Astros, we have two more players I want to talk about. What are your thoughts on the Dallas Keuchel start for the Braves? Because I have mine. But what are your thoughts on what Dallas did with his first start with the Braves?
I thought it was better than what the back three-fifths of their starting rotation had been giving them. And so from that aspect, it's a win for the Braves to have Dallas Keuchel. I know what, you know, he didn't, three strikeouts I think he had. He didn't walk anyone, gave up a lot of hits. It's probably about the start that you expected, and I don't think one start can really tell you where he winds up. But I still think he's better than what they had available at the time to them. So in that aspect, I actually think the Braves did a smart move in getting Keuchel. And I know you probably don't agree with that.
No, my issue isn't with the intelligence of the move, right? My issue isn't was my question, or at least my feeling isn't, does Dallas make the starting rotation of the Braves better? Because he does. I think that I've always had just sort of an issue with Dallas that maybe borderlines on personal that I can't really even just discuss him anymore, because part of my issue was him coming out and saying, yep, that's not really kind of what I was expecting. When for me, it was a very typical Dallas Keuchel start that we have seen from him since halfway through the, you know, since post All-Star break of 2017. He doesn't strike people out. He also doesn't walk. He's a soft contact guy, gives up a lot of hits, and he'll give you about three or four runs. He's basically Wade Miley. And I think that for people, so somehow he's got this persona of him being, you know, a Scherzer or, you know, one of those guys. But really what he is he's probably a pretty decent number three or number four starter. I think that's the big disconnect. Remember, we were talking about this when we were prepping the show a couple months ago, and he kept saying, well, I just want what I'm worth in the market. Well, the market was telling you what you were worth. Like, that's how a market works.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, if you could look back at what he did in 2015 and then he did it again in 2017, he wants to get paid for those years where he had a 2.48 ERA and 120 and a 2.9 ERA and won almost, you know, three quarters of his games. But the market can't let him forget 2014, where he didn't win as many games, or 2016, where he lost more than he won, or 2018, what you're talking about, where he was really a 500 pitcher for a team that had World Series winning talent.
Yeah. I mean, so he's still the guy that, you know, and we'll move on to my next question, but he's still the guy that led to the greatest game in World Series history by giving up four runs in the first three innings and that of game five of the World Series. And that's not, that isn't $100 million across 6 year. You know, that's not what you pay for in that perspective. And I'll give you the last word on that.
Well, since he's with the Braves, and I would liken it to this. He wants to be paid Tom Glavin numbers, but he's producing Steve Avery quality, which isn't bad, but no. It's not Glavin.
It's Wade Miley. Now, here's the thing. I want to ask you an outside perspective on a Houston Astro, and I can hear one of our biggest fans, Ken, and his son Matthew, the baseball traveler. They are playing their drinking game. Every time I mention the Astros, they drink soda because it's their father and son. But let me ask you this.
Well, plus they don't want to be completely hammered within half an hour.
They don't.
Right. But lying drunk.
the thing we had, but it ties back. You know, we have talked about Jordan Alvarez or Jordan Alvarez. The pronunciations, they're still kind of working on it. But when was the last time you saw a rookie come out of the minors and be as professional a hitter? Because it isn't even just the fact that the guy's hit like 8 bombs or something, but he's taken walks on pitches that you would like. I did not expect this. When was the last time you saw what we're seeing in Houston out of a mid-season call-up, like, which is basically what he is?
Yeah, so the one thing that people have to remember, first of all, about Jordan Alvarez, and I'm going to say Jordan because that's just cooler than saying Jordan, for this guy, but he's from Cuba. And the guys in Cuba, first of all, you never know if their age really is what they say their age is.
Like, they think Yuli Gurriel is somewhere between 30 and 48, so you're right.
Yeah, but they come out experienced, do they not? These guys come out, you come off that island, you know, they say that the way off the island of Dominica is to be able to hit a curveball. The way off the island of Cuba is to be either a power pitcher or just an incredibly fantastic power hitter. This guy, I don't know if I can liken his start to anything else, because the way he's jumped out has been phenomenal. I don't think anyone could have predicted that he was going to do this, even though, you know, I mean, he was tearing the cover off the ball at the AAA level.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He had 20 home runs for Round Rock.
Yeah, he had 23 home, and he almost had walked as many times as he had struck out. There's a lot to be said for that. There was something that he figured out, and for some reason, his climb through the minors was slower than maybe a lot of teams thought it would be. You know, I'd taken a look at this because I thought you might ask me about that. When he was at A-ball, he started off, he just tore the cover off the ball at full A, so they advanced him up, and he slowed down a little bit. Okay, well, bit of a hiccup, but they still moved him to double A. He tears the cover off the ball. They slow him down. Well, he slowed down once he got to triple A. Now he starts off this year with triple A, and he hasn't slowed down whenever he hit the majors. All of his numbers, everything kind of matches up. His strikeout rate is dropped. His walk rate has increased. All of the things that you want to see from a scout, from a stat perspective, this guy is bringing. I think he's maybe the real deal. Pretty sure he is, which makes things very interesting. Being in Houston, where you're kind of loaded to begin with, and now this guy shows up. So,
well, all right, here you go. You got 90 seconds. What was it like? You know, it's funny because we had our good buddy Mike Donis on this last week talking about his Raptors. Two of my best friends in the world get titles in two consecutive nights. Tell me about just everything that for the Blues winning. What does that mean for you?
What it means for me, for the entire city, right? So the St. Louis Blues came into existence as the second set of 6 teams in the NHL in 1967. Because of the way that the NHL drew up their leagues, all the new 6 teams went into one division, all the old teams went into the other division. Thereby, one of the new 6 teams was going to the Stanley Cup Finals every year. So the Blues did that, and were swept every year by the established teams that had all of the talent, right? So the last time the Blues had been in the Stanley Cup Finals was 1970. I was born in 1971. So before my lifetime was the last time they were there, and they were swept by the Boston Bruins. So I got to watch the Blues win their first Stanley Cup game ever. I was at the game when they won their first home game ever. And I was at Busch Stadium at a watch party, watching whenever we clinched game 7. There were, you know, it took 2-3 hours to get out of downtown. There were tears. There was 1.5 million people that Saturday for the parade in the rain, the entire city going absolutely crazy. It's one of those things where I saw grown men, I saw elderly men with tears streaming down their eyes because they thought they'd never see it. Or younger guys that were crying, saying, "My grandfather lost the team, or I just lost my grandfather recently, and they love this team, and they would have loved to be here." I liken it to when the Cubs won the World Series, and it was fantastic. Now, hopefully, 1 year, Mike Donis, since we're talking about Mike, his Maple Leafs can win one of these and get off the schneid as well. But congrats to him and the Raptors for now. Although I could, I don't care what happens in the NBA.
I don't either.
Baseball sounds good.
But you know what?
The last thing I wanted to mention also, from a College World Series perspective, we got a great series happening this week. Vanderbilt, who was my pick, is up against the Cinderella story, the Michigan Wolverines. I know Michigan Wolverines should never be said with Cinderella story.
And you predicted their demise.
Absolutely. I thought they'd fall apart.
They couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah. Michigan may be a sweet little story cooking up here, but they've got their hands full in a Vanderbilt team that's just amazing. I think Vanderbilt sweeps it against Michigan, but I could be dead wrong. We'll see. It's going to be fun to watch the ping of the bat the next two or three nights.
Go, go, Astros! A focus on H-Town Hardball.
All right, so we are back on Go, Go, Astros with Andy Tomcheson, and we are going to talk about the positives of a 7-game losing streak. Are there any?
His name is Jordan Alvarez. And Michael Brantley was hitting over 400 last week. Besides that, not too much to talk about. Good segment.
Yeah, and that'll wrap it up. No, really, the best part, I think, of the weekend, at least, was what George Springer did in Corpus.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to him hopefully being back in Houston tomorrow night. I think that's one of the things, it's real easy to overemphasize a series in June, and by no means trying to sugarcoat the way the Astros played for the last week. Literally any way they could lose the game, they lost a game. One game they had three errors. One game they blew a save, and they haven't blown a save in forever. So much lack of hitting with runners in scoring position and just bad pitching decisions. And it was a bad week. But it's a series. It's a couple of series in June. We still have a 6.5 game lead last time I checked. We're going to get Springer back this week. We're going to go in the All-Star break with a very favorable schedule. I think you can pick up those 7 games in the loss column back in the win column pretty easily, or at least with not too much struggle. And I think a big key of that, as you mentioned, is George Springer coming back and solidifying that lineup a little bit more. Because what that's going to do is put him back in the leadoff spot and push everybody else back one spot in the batting order. Beyond the energy Springer brings, and it's the weirdest thing, but it's worked. We obviously won a World Series and 2 division titles so far with him in the leadoff spot. That's what makes the Astros offense go. He's high energy. He gets on base. He gets clutch hits. He turns over the bottom of the lineup and scores runs with those guys when they get on base. I think you'll see a better Altuve, and I think you'll see a better Bregman now that he doesn't have to carry the weight of the team on his shoulders completely like he has for the last 3-4 weeks.
I also realize, too, that we have a bunch of friends and fans of the show who are fans of teams like, the Athletics and the Rangers and stuff like that. So when we talk about problems with the Astros, I bet there's a lot of eye rolling going on. But Bregman, 20 home runs, but – what was he, 4 for his last 20, I think, in the series. It does seem like maybe he's in his head a little bit. I don't know. What do you think's going on with him?
I think it's fatigue, and that's weird to say because he's in his early 20s and it's early in the season, but I think it's a different game when you are surrounded by a healthy George Springer, a healthy Jose Altuve, a healthy Carlos Correa, and Brantley and Alvarez and all that. When it's you and you're batting leadoff and that's not what you're accustomed to do, and you're accustomed to be able to see, what a pitcher's bringing through the first couple of batters at least, and you're able to come up with people on base, it's you know, I think we've talked about it before, but baseball players are creatures of habit and routine. And when you break that routine even a little bit, even the best of them take a while to adjust. And I'm not at all as down on Bregman as Bregman is down on Bregman. If you listen to any interviews, you'd think he's about to commit suicide. Fastball.
No, you're right. Well, and I think you bring something interesting up too, because Bregman's one of, I think we've talked about this before, one of the most analytical, like, student of the game baseball players we've seen. And I do wonder if a guy like George Springer, who's a free swinger, who's going to swing at the first pitch, versus a guy like Bregman, who almost never does, I wonder if that does offer, if that does spell out why one's really better in the leadoff spot than the other.
I think the other thing, I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is that pitchers know, especially when you're facing a lot more teams that use this opener role, they know that he's going to take pitches. They know he's going to want to see what he can see being delivered to him. And he's, you know, to that point, he's been walked 51 times, I believe. Yeah, 58 times, excuse me, which is certainly top 10, if not top 5 in Major League Baseball right now. And so they're not giving anything to hit. And when he gets something to hit, he's a little bit over anxious right now. And I think he'd be the first person to say that. His doubles are way down from last year. His walks are way up. Still has good plate presence. And again, we're nitpicking, because this guy is literally sitting with a 910 OPS. He's slugging 522. He's getting on base 39% of the time. His batting average is not where we want it to be. That's literally the only thing that's not, doesn't look good on paper. And the fact that he acts like he's unhappy literally all the time.
Yeah, and you do got to wonder how much of that is affecting things. Although it was nice to see him kind of react when we talked about Altuve coming back, and I do think it's a team unlike a lot of what we've seen before, where they do really rely on each other more than just at the plate. I think there's a real, like, bond between particularly the members of that core four or five.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting things when you get into what we're almost a month out from the trade deadline. It's a real weird tightrope that Lunau is going to have to walk with. Who do you deal from the current roster to make the team better? Because it's easy for me to sit here and look at a stat sheet or watch games from, you know, my couch and say, well, you know, Yuli Gurriel is underperforming. Let's see what we can get for him. Josh Reddick's expendable because we have Kyle Tucker in the minors. Let's see what we can get for him. But those guys are huge pieces of the chemistry of the team. And, you know, your point of relying on, it's not just relying on batting order protection. It's relying on guys who have been through the wars with you that you trust. And that's, we get very deep into the stats sometimes as fans, and you forget this is a game, and a lot of the game is hinged on emotion and hinged on the belief that you can do something. I think the Astros really believe that they can do something with the current lineup with a couple of tweaks. Would I like to see Tyler White off the roster, even though he had a grand slam yesterday? Absolutely. but he's well-liked in that clubhouse. And so maybe he's not as big a chemistry guy as Josh Reddick is, but at some point, some things have to, some things are going to have to shake out and look like changes are going to be made, but it's a real delicate procedure to tinker with the chemistry of a championship team.
And I don't want to get too much trade deadline, because you and I are going to talk at least twice more before that. But I do have two coming back from injury questions for you. One, it's three, I guess. So first, as we start to get everybody back, Tyler White has played better. I think somebody pointed out that he had the highest OPS on the road trip, albeit a 1-7 or 1-6 road trip. Do you see what he's done better, basically adding to potential trade value, or do you think he is securing a spot on the roster, if you had to guess?
I think you have the question of how I would see that as a fan versus how Jeff Lunau sees that as a general manager. Lunau, right or wrong, really values his prospects to the point that some have argued he's held on to him for a little bit too long. I think White for me is one of those guys that is fungible. I know that the Astros think he has potential, but I'm okay with him realizing that potential somewhere else.
Okay. So, but the other thing, two things, did you ever think there would be a situation in March where you felt like that two players coming back would be big boosts, and those players being Aledmys Diaz and Joe Smith?
I had high hopes for Diaz. I mean, he is, I know the All-Star games kind of is what it is, but he is a former All-Star. So that means that at some point he has hit in his career. Defense was questionable, and I think it was a stretch to consider him the next Marwin Gonzalez on our roster. But I had high hopes for him. He started off very slow, and as we've talked about, the footballization of baseball continues. You get impatient with guys that start off slow. Perfect example, that's Kyle Tucker. There are people who have completely written him off because in 72 at-bats didn't set the world on fire. Diaz was one of those guys in April that just he didn't do a lot, had a couple of critical errors, and people started writing him off. And since that point, he was a key offensive member of the team to the point that you could legitimately have replaced Tyler White with him at first base and been a better team. But he got hurt. So I have high hopes for him from an offensive standpoint. It'll be interesting to see how they juggle it with him coming back. The bullpen's a completely different issue. The fact that we keep calling up Guan amazes me, and it's just testament to the fact that we have no middle relief depth on the team. And I guess he's supposed to be a left-handed specialist. I don't know what's special about him. Joe Smith, with his arsenal of pitches, brings a ability, even though he's right-handed, to pitch to a left-handed hitter and get them out successfully. And I think his career numbers kind of back that up. So I think that removes both of them coming back or remove some weak points from the 25 man.
Absolutely. And I think actually Joe Smith had a perfect inning in Corpus. I have to look at that. But I think he threw basically 9 strikes. I need to go. And I know he struck out the side. I don't know if it was a perfect inning.
The immaculate inning.
So as you know, as we wrap up, then what do you expect to see out of the neck? You know, as we run into the All-Star break, you think there's any bumps in the road? I think Colorado's the only team over 500.
You know, the Pirates are a tough team, as we learned in Cincinnati last week. I don't think the Astros at this point can take anybody for granted. The good news is we're playing at home. We're going to have to weather the we've got two facing your prior team situations tomorrow night with Garrett Cole facing the Pirates for the first time since he was traded. And then Joe Musgrove's going to start against the Astros on Wednesday night. So those things will be interesting. But yeah, the schedule sets up pretty nicely with 3 against the Pirates at home and then 3 against the Mariners at home, who have given up. I mean, realistically, they traded away Encarnacion. I think you and I might be able to try out and make the roster for a couple of days.
Right.
And then the Angels are still bad. That's just a constant thing we get to talk about, is the Angels being bad. And this feels like 3 years going on. They sign great free agents and spend money poorly and don't have pitching, and they're just bad. So, yeah, the 2 against the Rockies in Colorado. But I'm happy that Springer's back for that. I'm happy that Altuve's got 5 hits in his last 2 games. So I think the schedule sets up pretty favorably through the All-Star break. But then we go out to play the Rangers after that. And I think the Rangers, we play 6 of the next 10 games against the Rangers. So that'll be fun, hopefully swatting them back down to a distant second place, or maybe third place with Oakland coming back a little bit.
Yeah, Oakland losing Montas, that doesn't help. Okay, last question. Does Joe Musgrove get a Marwin-esque video before his start on Thursday?
He gets no Marwin-esque video because he did nothing while he was here. I mean, you would have to actually have video. There would have to be video of you to make a video for you, right? So I can't recall, you know, other than I know he blew a couple leads, pitched well for about a month in 2017. Beyond that, I'm not sure. He'd be right up there with the Tyler White appreciation video that I'm hoping we're seeing next year.
maybe we can just show Cole highlights since he was from when he joined the Astros. That might work for it.
That honestly was Joe Musgrove's greatest contribution to the franchise so far.
Absolutely. All right, Andy, thanks for being on. We'll talk to you after the All-Star break.
All right. Sounds good, Jeff.
From the bleachers, the Let's Get To Game of the Week.
Now, quick disclaimer for our From the Bleachers segment, because again, we are not coming to you from the bleachers. We just had a really cool opportunity to talk to the folks behind Ballpark to Ballpark. We're going to put the link to find out more about what the book is about, but without further ado, here's the interview. So we have a very special guest on Let's Get To. We are joined by John Hoppen. He is one half of the author of Ballpark to Ballpark, along with his wife, Vicky, and they have... As I told him earlier, been living my best life by doing nothing but seeing America's ballparks. John, thanks so much for joining the show.
Oh, you're more than welcome, and I really appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a couple of people that we've connected with through this show. Ken Robertson, known as the Baseball Traveler, for one, who has really kind of dove into this idea of minor league ballparks and what it means for America. So how did you and Vicky get started doing it in the first place?
Well, it was really a decision about traveling more than baseball. And in 2012, we decided to leave California. Vicky wanted to travel, specifically maybe do some RV life. And I didn't really want to do that. we were really entrenched in San Jose, California I'm a former college umpire and doing umpiring in the area and just some, other things. And then going to, the San Jose Giants games, and both of us retired, but she said, well, what if we do baseball? And of course I went, oh, sure.
Right.
And loving minor league baseball the way that I had come to love it, knowing a great deal of minor league umpires and going to the San Jose Giants games. And she loved it, too. And we did some Lincoln Salt Dog games when we were in Lincoln visiting family, which is where we are right now in Lincoln, Nebraska. So she said, well, OK, darn. That means I'm going to be in a lot of ballparks. But wait a minute. I'm a photographer. And she is. She's a professional photographer, very good at it. And so, well, maybe I could take some pictures. And it kind of morphed into this concept of why don't we set up a kind of a plan to go to as many ballparks as we can over the summers of 2013. And we kind of went, let's do 4 years. So we did actually ended up doing 4+ seasons. And that's how it got started. And we just hit the road, pointed our nose in the right direction, and we looked at the maps of minor league baseball teams around the country, including independents, because we understood, the value of independent baseball as well,
right,
to the fans, and we got started, and there we go. 160 ballparks later.
160. Well, first of all, I love the fact that you started out as an umpire and still love the game. it's funny because I kind of came to this. I'm an independent filmmaker and run one of the biggest independent film festivals in the world. That's what I do. And sometimes the last thing I want to do was watch an independent film. So I love the fact that working in it didn't kill your love of the game.
No, not at all. Not at all. If anything, it enhanced it. So.
And so talk about just the journey then. What have been some of the parks that you guys have visited that you've really connected with and like the best?
Well, our very first ballpark was Midland, Texas in 2013.
Go Rockhounds.
Yes, for the very first park that we called officially, in our journey. And, right off the bat, it was noticing how things were a little bit different then. Other parks we had been at, a beautiful ballpark there in Midland, wonderful staff, great mascot, and great fans. And we found some good stories there, and we moved on. And, and as we started to go, very early on, people were asking us about our favorite ballpark. And when you had, maybe half a dozen or 10 underneath your belt, kind of hard to say what's the best ballpark, but we, some of them stood out more than others. Frisco was very early in in our tour of ballparks. And that, of course, is one of the standards around minor league baseball, the Frisco Rough Riders and Dr. Pepper Field. And so we, you know, and then we just started. We concentrated on the West for two seasons, pretty much because of the geography and some other things, some personal things in our life that we needed to be at. We needed to be in Vancouver in 2013, so we took a drive that way. And we also had a wedding to do. Our son got married, and so we planned around that too. And so there were personal things that we needed to plan around, and we did that. And so we concentrated, like I said, on the West Coast, kind of west of the Mississippi, did a little bit of East Coast stuff, but then we headed out into the South and into the East in 15 and 16. And then again, we hit a couple more ballparks in the season 2017. We got two more in there. So.
And so as you guys have been traveling, you know, one of the things I love the most about minor league baseball is how I think a really good park reflects the culture of in the community that it's in. So what did you learn and see about parts of America that you hadn't been to through the ballparks that you guys visited and took photos of?
Well, first of all, there's a common thread in baseball and I think in the communities across the country. There are some very, very good people in our country. I mean, genuinely nice folks that, you know, they're all working hard. They're, you know, and they love baseball and they're just, you know, pretty common folks. And we found that to be true in a lot of these, even in big cities, but certainly in the small towns. And the beauty of our country, the enthusiasm that people still have for baseball and for family fun. I mean, that's what our take was on this. And that's why our books concentrate on the fun, family and fans of minor league baseball. I mean, we saw that throughout the country. And impressed with certain parts of the country we had never been to, certainly the Carolinas. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. The hills of the Appalachian Mountains, you know, I hated driving them in the
right.
RV because they're so up and down, but they're gorgeous. They're beautiful, you know. And so we did get to see a lot of the country, a lot of the expansiveness in the country, like, you know, driving from Sioux Falls, South Dakota to Fargo, North Dakota. I mean, it's pretty flat up there.
It's pretty flat, yeah.
But it's also, it has its beauty as well. So.
Yeah, I love the direction, too, that minor league baseball has taken where I think embracing the fact that they can be smaller and more intimate and also, therefore, kind of cooler new designs. And I know yes. that there've been some new parks open. Like have you been out to Fayetteville yet? Or have you been out to Amarillo to see the new parks out there?
We did not make it to Amarillo, but we did have the opportunity to go to Biloxi. And however, it was under construction when we were there. We ended up actually seeing the team in Huntsville, the old stadium, but you know, yeah, that's Biloxi's gorgeous. And we showed up for the last season of the St. Paul Saints in their old stadium in Midway. And then they opened up the new one, CHS Field, in downtown St. Paul, which is an absolutely gorgeous park, along with some pretty crazy antics that they do in St. Paul, Minnesota. Our overall probably favorite franchise in minor league baseball, just because it epitomizes the craziness of minor league baseball. They have a lot of fun there.
Yeah. One of the things that I'd noticed that just in our show, we covered like the Sugarland Skeeters and then we covered the Cleveland Railroaders and the independent league. They take that minor league baseball thing to 11 when it comes to just the antics and the craziness.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's like no holds barred. Right. And they don't really have and not that it's a bad thing or a good thing, but they don't have that sort of MLB overlook, you know. It's like, you know, it's the owner that owns the team and, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, this is what I want to do. Let's do it. Sugarland's a very good example. We were there opening day in, I think it was 15, and it was an incredible fly-in and, you know, parachute drop and
yeah,
just, and a great, great ballpark. That is an exquisite ballpark. We were just there a few weeks ago, actually. So.
It's one of my favorites, not just because they put me on the radio during the play-by-play, but that's a big part of it. I was just the whole time I'm like, oh my God, I'm on the play-by-play of a radio. But yeah, it was funny when we were up in Cleburne about a week and a half ago, the St. Paul Saints were there and threw a no-hitter. And I walked into the press booth, and they both looked at me going, did you bring a no-hitter with you? And I was like, hold on. No. Not intentionally. One of my favorite leagues, though, in minor league baseball is the Florida State League. But I find the parks weird because – and I wanted your take on this because one of the things, again, like when you go to the Midland Rockhounds, it feels like the Midland Rockhounds. When you go to the Tampa Tarpons, they want to remind you that they're the Yankees. Yes. But yet Fort Myers, which is the home of the Twins, they do a really good job of splitting the difference as far as identity. Where does – like just your sort of personal preference in how teams split that identity between – hey, we're a part of this parent club versus we are our own stadium. How do you feel like that plays to the public?
Well, I think I think that the local branding is great, especially for teams that have been in a particular market for a long time. And so, you know, when you get the Asheville Tourists as an example, and the affiliations tend to change quite, you know, rapidly. I mean, it could be every 3 to 4 years they're changing. However, I think there's a trend right now. You could correct me if I'm wrong, that more and more of the parent clubs in Major League Baseball are buying a little bit more interest in those minor league clubs. So the ownership then becomes kind of a joint thing. And so therefore the branding and the connection to the Major League club will continue for perhaps a longer period of time as far as affiliation is concerned. As far as the fans are concerned, they love the fact that, you know, they might be connected to a certain team. I'm trying to think of, as an example, the Memphis Redbirds, for crying out loud. I mean, they're still called the Redbirds, but boy, they're Cardinal country right there in Memphis, Tennessee. So, you know, I you know, communities will align themselves to the team that's local, but I think there's always that wonderful connection that they have to the parent club as well.
Yeah. And to your point, the thing I've noticed just doing the show, and again, we're going to be about 20 episodes in this week, but it seems like a lot of teams are buying up their low A affiliate, like the Astros own the Woodpeckers. The thing that just kind of I found interesting was that while the Astros own the Woodpeckers, it is the Woodpeckers. You know, you definitely see some of that relationship versus, again, walking into Tampa, into basically mini Yankee Stadium. To your point, though, or sort of one of the things that I found was interesting, I'm assuming you've made it out to the Tacoma Rainiers, Cheney Stadium.
Yes. Great view from the third base side, by the way.
That was, you know, absolutely one of my favorite ones that we've been to so far. And it really, what struck me was that connection to community felt really strong because it does feel like the city of Tacoma is trying to remind everybody that we are our own city and not the suburb of Seattle. And I noticed right away that there's almost no Mariner iconography in Cheney Stadium.
It seemed to be rare when we were out on the road for those four seasons that we would even see the Major League club's paraphernalia, if you will, merchandise in their stores. That was kind of rare. We noticed coming out in the last two summers to do book signings that seems to be changing a little bit. I can't recall off the top of my head, but even earlier this season, we were in a park and they were showcasing some of the parent club's gear. But as far as your comment about community, I think that again is the incredible experience when you walk into a minor league park and you see the people embracing each other as if they're family, and they are connected to the community. There's local tables set, you know, tables set up for local charities. And I'm reminded also of the Rockland Boulders in the independent Can-Am, I think Can-Am, yeah, Can-Am League. They have a fabulous community relations program up there in the Rockland, New Jersey. I keep getting that wrong. But so, yes, an incredible connection to the local community, absolutely.
Well, and one of the things I hope, like, by having you on, and I think the whole mission of our podcast is to remind people that, you know, and you were an umpire, you can get this. There's good baseball being played. And I think that there's this outside impression that if, oh, I'm going to an independent league game or I'm going to a minor league game, it's like I'm going to go watch the XFL or the whatever that thing was that the football had that just closed. But I don't know that the difference is that small. Like if you go to watch the Rainiers play the Round Rock Express, the competition level's not that different than if you're watching the Mariners versus the Astros.
No, it's very good baseball up and down. Obviously in the rookie and probably low A leagues, they're still ironing out some issues, you know, that makes it for an interesting game. Sometimes when you see some, you know, you might even see a little league triple, if you will, and they do throw the ball around occasionally, but for the most part, those games are incredibly competitive and great to watch. And you're seeing, I mean, when you have an opportunity, I had an opportunity to see Carlos Correa when he was playing in the Cal League and in Southern California, as I believe he was an 18-year-old, and he got my attention. It was just, and you get to see somebody like that, you know, that all of a sudden you'll be standing in line with your hot dog and you hear the crack of the bat and you know, oh, that was a shot, you know, and you go, oh, who was that?
Right.
Let's look him up. And that's also the joy of being a fan of a minor league club, you know, is watching those prospects come through the system. Absolutely.
I love that.
Baseball is very good.
And I love that you said that about the crack of the bat, because it reminded me of that quote from Buck O'Neill in Ken Burns' documentary about how just every 20 years or something, you're going to hear a sound and it's going to remind you of why baseball is like the best thing. And it's that.
That's right.
So,
yeah, or even, and here's, let me add a little something else. Because of the minor league system, the minor league clubs and the configuration of the baseball field, you know this, you've been to enough of them. The bullpens aren't that far away. And so you could literally stand above the bullpen and watch people work out. Some of them are on the field. And because the seats are close, you start listening for that pop of the mitt.
Well, right. Yeah.
You know? And you go, ooh, that was quick. You know.
No, exactly. And one of the things that you and I have in common is, and I'm going to assume this based on what has been a 15-minute phone call. You seem to have been smart enough to marry a super talented woman, and you guys work together. And my wife and I do the same thing. And so, how has that part of it been? You and Vicky working together on this project.
Well, it's been, you know, you got to remember that for 5.5 years, we lived full time in the RV. So that was 24/7, even during the winter months. We would park the RV in Arizona and stay in the RV. We didn't buy a house on the ground, if you will, until about 2 years ago. So so we get along most of the time pretty well.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't think we would have lasted. But there's always those moments. And then putting the book together, it was kind of an interesting thing because I wanted to go through all these stories. And we ended up deciding that we would go with the anecdotal stories and then she would plug in the photography. And she plugged in some outstanding photographs. They may, in fact, not necessarily be her most favorite photographs because she was kind of going along with the story, but that's what she did. And the books have been well received by people in baseball. And a lot of the comments, of course, not everybody starts reading the stories right away. They're thumbing through the pages.
Right, right.
And then one of their first things, oh, these are beautiful photographs. These are wonderful photographs, you know. And of course, so it did work out, you know, and we have worked it out. So we've done okay.
And then the question that you always ask a filmmaker after his film screens at a festival is, what's next? So what's next for you guys?
Well, we're going to the immediate what next is to continue to take volume 2 and volume 1 out on the road. We have some planned book signings already. Certainly we're going to be in Papillion and then in St. Paul. So we're going to try to finish going, through the Western states this year. And then after that, it's possible that you may see a third book, but what it's going to be is a photography book. So this is where Vicky will then get to take charge of some of her best and favorites and put them in a photo book. And the most that I'll have involved in that is probably some captioning or something like that. So it'll be definitely photography driven, more of a photography book than a book about minor league baseball.
Well, I for one can't wait. John, thanks so much for being on Let's Get Two.
Well, I appreciate everything you've done, everything you continue to do for baseball. I love it. Thank you.
On deck, the Let's Get Two interview of the week, brought to you by Fine Line Sportswear.
Before the season, we had the chance to sit down and talk to Tom Nichols, the Director of Media Relations and Broadcasting for the Dayton Dragons, to talk about the wonderfully special thing they've got going on in Dayton, one of the most popular draws in minor league baseball. Thought it'd be a good idea to drop the interview a few weeks before I actually get up to Dayton to see what it's all about. Tom, thanks so much for joining Let's Get To.
Thank you for having me today.
So you are the voice of the Dayton Dragons, and you have been calling MILB games for over 30 years. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I've been with the Dragons for 12 years, and I'll be heading in my 32nd year in the minor leagues.
So how did you get into broadcasting in the first place, and how did you end up as the voice of the Dragons?
Well, let's go back to getting into the game initially. That would have happened, my first year would have been 1988 in the minor leagues with the Indianapolis Indians. And I guess I owe it all to the longtime radio broadcaster for the Indians, Howard Kelman. He's actually been there in that role with that team since 1974. So he's, I would imagine, been at it longer than anyone else in the minor leagues today. Might be a couple that are pretty close. And I grew up as a Reds fan, listening to Reds games on radio, and made a decision to try to pursue a career in that same type of position. Came out of college, had broadcast games with my college station, and my high school actually had a radio station as well. So came out of college still intent on pursuing a career as a baseball broadcaster. Called the Indianapolis team, which was the closest team to me. It was about 60 miles or so down the road, and asked to speak with their broadcaster, who I'd listened to on the radio many times. Didn't have any idea if he would even call me back, but took a chance. He called me back and told me that my question was generally just basically, how do I get a job in the minor leagues? Not so much, can I work for your team? But he did mention to me that they had a position at that time that was open for about 25 games that season, and if I would send a tape, he would consider me for that role. So I got at that time it was cassette tapes, if you can believe that, got the cassette tape out in the mail to him, and he listened to it, invited me to do one game, which happened to be their opening day game, and I could still hear him say at the end of the night, Tom, we've got some more games for you. And that was music to my ears, of course, at that point. And I ended up doing about 25 games that season with that team and about 25 the next year with the same team. And then got my first primary position with the team. I was the voice of the Kinston Indians in 1990, a team that had future star Jim Thome on the roster. And that was my first time as a primary announcer for a team. And from there, it continued onward, and I've been with a few teams. I wanted to come back to the Midwest, and in 2008, the Dayton job opened up, and I applied for it and was fortunate enough to get selected for this position. I'm heading into my 12th year here. It's been a great place for me, and probably close out the career here if things go well over the next 10 years or so.
So you mentioned that you were a Reds fan, and this will be my opportunity to lament. I practically grew up at the Astrodome, and so I just got to remind myself that we're not in the NL Central anymore. What a bummer!
It still is a strange thought to those of us who had it really tattooed into our brains that the Astros were a National League team. And of course, I'm going back to when you had two divisions of six teams each. And the Astros were in the same division as the Reds in National League West. And that's back in the days of J.R. Richard and Doug Rader and Jose Cruz, Terry Poole, some of those types of players. Joe Niekro was a little bit later maybe. But that was an Astro group that I remember pretty well.
That's absolutely my childhood. So first of all, I want to congratulate you too. Last year you hit a really big milestone with your 4,000th game. So just congratulations on that. That's amazing.
Thank you very much. I didn't expect it to really be something too many people would care much about, but it did get a lot of publicity, and I'm not really an attention seeker, but it was nice that people did recognize that and show their appreciation, and I was thankful for those that took time to take note of the 4,000th game.
You know, so there's the famous quote that says, baseball is the only game you can see on the radio, and again, going back to my Astros days, I grew up you know, Milo Hamilton was kind of the voice of my childhood. For you, before, you know, you got into doing it yourself and sending in tapes for auditions, who were some of the broadcasters that really connected with you?
Well, there were two, probably, on a regional level. The first person I actually listened to as a baseball broadcaster on a nightly basis would have been Al Michaels. He was, at that time, the Cincinnati Reds broadcaster, play-by-play man. That would have been 1971, 72, 73. He then left there, and after the 73 season, went to the San Francisco Giants and was replaced by a young AAA announcer who eventually became a legend in Reds country by the name of Marty Brenneman. And Marty's in the Baseball Hall of Fame as a broadcaster now. This will actually be his final season. And so I grew up from 74 onward, and I would have been 10 years old in 1974. So he would have been the play-by-play man that I basically grew up listening to once Al Michaels left for San Francisco. And so those two probably more than anything set the example of what I came to find to be the style that eventually sort of became my style in many ways.
You know, currently the Astros guys, you know, Robert Ford, Steve Sparks, they do a great job. And I was listening to a game last year and the Astros just got destroyed. And I remember thinking as I was listening to the game, the effort that it must have taken for Robert and Steve to talk about enough stuff to keep the experience interesting because the game no longer was. How do you do that when, you know, the Dragons are either way up or they're way behind and you just basically have to fill time with something interesting that might not even be baseball related? How do you kind of prepare that stuff? You have like a file of stuff to talk about just in case it happens, or is it just sort of off the cuff?
Good question, and that is a challenge when that happens, and especially if it happens fairly frequently. If you're, it's a particular season where your team is struggling, and everybody has those once in a while, unless you're the voice of the New York Yankees or in football the New England Patriots. But everybody's going to go through those kind of years, and even in those years, there's going to be some days where you struggle with maintaining interest because the game itself becomes a blowout. And minor league baseball is a little different than the major leagues in that regard, in that your audience is a little more, I would say, individual-oriented in terms of the players themselves. And you got to keep in mind that there are people tuned in, even though the game, the score may be that may be lopsided. They may be tuned in as a fan of a particular player, and to them, they're listening to see how that player is going to perform. So my position is you don't want to get away from the game. You want to keep announcing the game. You want to try to make things as interesting as possible by throwing in anecdotes that you might not have time for. In over 140 game season, there's a lot of material that's needed. So we do most of the games either solo or I have one other person that works with me on home games. So there's a lot of solo broadcasts. All road games are solo for me. So, I maintain that position that there's still someone out there. There are people out there listening, and I try to maintain a sort of a bond in that I imagine one person that I'm talking to in the audience, and I'm describing the game for literally that one person, and that gets me through. You've got to, again, keep in mind that, and my attitude is always, you're only as strong as your weakest game or weakest part of a game, because that might be the game or that inning that someone tuned in, that's not me, the only inning they heard you. So if you have an inning where you just fax it in and get completely away from the game or whatever the case may be, that may be the only inning that person ever heard you, and they're going to walk away and say that person was awful. So for me, it's that's the attitude I try to take, is that for every moment of every game, there's someone new tuning in that's never heard me broadcast a game before, and I want to make a positive impression on that person for that particular inning, and that's the approach I take for those games that become blowout losses or even blowout wins in some cases are sort of similar. We had a season in 2016 where the bottom fell out, you might say, and every night we knew was going to be a struggle. Those games are actually, you're less disappointed by those kinds of games than you are the games when you're in the race and you lose a game that you knew you should have won. Those are the really disappointing losses that are t- hard to stay positive. The game where you're in the divisional chase and you have a game that you know you should have won and somehow you let it get away, that's when you got to really be careful about getting negative. And so those are sort of the attitudes I take over the course of the season.
So you are the voice of the single A affiliate advanced for the Cincinnati Reds. And one of the things I love most about minor league baseball in general, and where I think that they really beat the MLB in a lot of ways, is the way they connect with fans, the way they connect with the community. So what are some of the ways, you know, we're talking about promotions, giveaways, that sort of thing, that the Dragons have done in the past that you have really thought was a great way of connecting with the community? And what do y'all have in store for the 2019 season?
Well, the Dragons baseball sort of signature is family entertainment and community involvement. Those are the two things going back to the very beginning in the year 2000 that this franchise has stayed with long before I got here and maintained over the years, is those two themes, family entertainment and community involvement. And so every season, it's been the attitude of this ball club that whether you come to a game on a cold April Tuesday night or a Saturday night in July when it's 80 degrees, either way, you're still going to get a very good night in terms of the effort we put in to making it entertaining for a baseball fan or not a baseball fan at all. So we'll do different things over the course of the season. We have a group that we refer to as the Green Team. Green is our primary color. And they orchestrate on the field between innings, sing-alongs, contests, skits, things like that. We have six mascots in the ballpark. And so we really go the extra mile to make sure that our entertainment is as strong as any team in minor league baseball. We do bring in 12 national acts each season, mostly on Friday and Saturday nights. That would be, you've probably seen them at some point, the Superstars, Bird Zerk, those types of acts. The San Diego Chicken has been here many times. And then
that's super cool.
Yeah, we also have six fireworks shows on our schedule this year. We do a lot of community related tie-ins on the field. For example, we've got a military base, an Air Force base here in our county, and we do a lot of tributes. We have swearing-in ceremonies on the field. We have six nights over the course of the season that we dedicate with a military theme, and that's, again, a way of connecting with the community. We have an event five times a year, once a month, that we call Community All-Stars, where we honor a person within our community who's done something unique above and beyond the call of duty. It might be it could be a police officer who's pulled a victim from a burning automobile and saved their life. It could be a fireman. It could be a business owner who started a business and raised awareness in some area. Community All-Stars for us. We have also an event once a month we do called Home Run for Life. This is a child that's had a serious illness that they've battled through the early years of their life. And we stop the game at the end of the third inning, and that child takes a lap around the bases and gets a standing ovation from the fans, gets a high five from every player on both teams as they line up on the foul lines as the child races around the bases. So these are the types of things that the Dragons are really famous for, and that's been a key to our success over the years. Dragons baseball has been very successful, as you may know. We're known sort of, I guess you could say, nationally for our sellout streak, 1,316 consecutive sold-out dates. That's the all-time record in North America. We broke the record in 2011 set by the Portland Trail Blazers of the NBA, and we've continued the streak onward. The record was 814 when we broke it, and we're standing now at 1,316 heading into this next season.
So you're saying for when I get my tickets for July this year, I should get them soon?
I would suggest that you do it within a day or two of individual tickets going on sale, yes. That would be a wise move if you can find time to do that, correct.
I will categorically do that. So just talk a little bit more about, you know, other ways that you guys are relating with the community. You said you had the military base, like just other ways that you guys reach out to the community and keep them involved.
Well, Well, we have a program called the Dragon School MVP program, which is we've had that in effect for more than 10 years. It's fourth and fifth grade classes throughout our area. That would include, I think, we're up over 30,000 kids involved in the program. Teachers in each classroom that is participating will select three classroom MVPs. Again, these are fourth and fifth grade classes. There'll be three classroom MVPs in each class. The teacher will select those based on, it could be whatever the teacher feels is most important, the student that's made the most improvement, the student that's been most helpful to classmates. It could be based on just overall grade performance. It could be attendance-based. Each teacher will pick three students, and then we'll have a night at the ballpark for each of those students and their families in which they'll get VIP treatment. They'll get a tour of the ballpark. They'll be involved in one of our entertainment skits. They've done radio interviews with me on air before. All those types of things are part of the school MVP program. And that's something we've, again, done for over 10 years, and it's, again, become our, sort of a trademark for us. We also have a number of other events at the ballpark all summer long. I like to say that our organization, we're really twofold. There's our 70-game home baseball season, and then we also use the ballpark for, again, events on days when the team's on the road. So I've never seen any of these because I travel with the ball club, but we have a 5K run every summer, for example. We have a beer tasting night at the ballpark. We have a kids movie night where kids can come out and sit in the outfield grass and watch a movie on our big screen video board. We do that every summer. We have a high school tournament basically every April and May. Area high school teams are able to come and play games on our field, the same dugouts as the Dragons team. We have baseball camps during the summer, so there are a number of events we have on the field or at the ballpark that allow the stadium itself to become more than just the home of the Dragons, but also the home of these other events that take place throughout the year.
That's so incredible. So, like I said, I'm coming up, I think, mid-July to see a game. What do you hope, as a member of the front office of the Dragons, that my experience is when I walk out of that?
Well, let's start off with a good weather night. That's something we can't control.
I'm escaping Texas in July. It's going to be a good weather night.
Yeah, well, yeah. You hopefully you'll get a night with temperatures maybe in the, oh, I don't know, mid-70s, I guess, with low humidity, and have a good night. You'll... depending on the specific night. Again, our attitude is we're going to give every fan, even if it's whatever night you might be attending a game, the same treatment. So when you enter the ballpark through the main gates, there'll be a member of our front office staff there to greet you, to say thank you for attending a game, whether you're coming from Texas or just down the road. That's, again, part of our process. And we really emphasize customer service. And a lot of people say that. It's an easy thing to say, but we take it to the next level. And customer service to us means a lot of things. That would mean, for example, that the restroom is just as clean in the seventh inning as it was in the first inning. Or if there's an issue with a ticket that we've had front office people actually go to the level of working out in advance. If there's a person that maybe an elderly person that's been a season ticket holder for a number of years, our front office people have actually allowed them to pull up, get out of their car near the main gate, and the front office person has parked the car for them and then brought it back to the main gate area when the person was ready to leave. So that's kind of the level we'll go to. We'll go to whatever level to maintain highest level of customer service. So if you come to the game, you'll be greeted at the main gate. You'll find your seat. You'll find, again, for the full nine innings that there'll be entertainment on the field. You'll hopefully see some future major leaguers, of course. We've had, in our 19 years, we've had 97 Dragons players advance onto the major leagues. Most famous names would be players like Joey Votto and Jay Bruce, Johnny Cueto, Adam Dunn and Austin Kearns from our early years, and more recently, players like Billy Hamilton and Todd Frazier. These are all former Dragons players that were here as prospects coming up through the system. And last season we had the most famous player in all of minor league baseball, Hunter Green, threw 102 miles an hour. So you'll see these things and leave hopefully with an appreciation for Dayton Dragons baseball.
Well, that just sounds incredible. I really can't wait. Thank you, Tom, so much for joining me on Let's Get To, and I can't wait to get up there in July.
We look forward to meeting you in person, and until then, enjoy your baseball season. Thanks a lot for having me on your show.
And now, on to close it out, the right-hander from Houston, Texas, James Christopher.
And that wraps us up for this weekend, and Jessica and I have a really busy Let's Get To weekend ahead of us, and actually it's beginning a really busy 2 weeks for us, but when this episode drops on Thursday morning, Jessica and I will be on the road to Amarillo to go check out the Sod Poodles for the first time and then to really experience a lot of what Amarillo has to offer with Paladuro Canyon and stuff like that. So as you're listening, be thinking about us on the 8-hour trip. And unfortunately, those of you who are wondering, because of when we're leaving, no, we will not reach Amarillo by morning. I don't know how to follow up a bad dad joke like that except for to say, let's get to it.